Well, it's time for Green Zine here just after 11 o'clock on a Thursday. If you just heard Radio Ikashakalata talk about wildfires, here's a well-known song from a band playing this weekend in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it is called Wildfire. This is Watch House. Stay tuned for environmental news and discussion here on Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio.
Brave men fall with the battle cry. Tears fill the eyes of their loved ones and their brothers in arms. So it went for Joseph Warren. It should have been different. It could have been easy. His reign could have saved him. But a country unborn is bravery. And it spread like wild. Wildfire. From the ashes grew sweet liberty, like the seeds of the pines. When the forest burns, they open up, grow, and burn again. It should have been different. It could have been easy, but too much money rolled. Ever in slavery, the cry for war spread like wildfire. Wildfire.
Turn down Watch House, but for those who head down to the Green Mountain Bluegrass and Roots Festival, you can hear them sing their songs all the way through. I think they're taking the stage on Saturday at around 4 p.m. It's a couple. I know that last year she was pregnant with their first child. Probably that little one will be backstage with babysitting. Maybe I'll get a chance to babysit. Oh, no, I'm not volunteering on Saturday afternoon. I'm on Friday. Anyway, this is Green Zine, and this is the time when I normally bring up my colleague up in the Queen City, I believe, unless he's on the road somewhere. Are you out there, Henry?
I'm at the Queen City, and we got a little bit of rain yesterday, but not much.
Yeah, not enough.
Maybe less than a quarter of an inch. I guess some places it rained pretty hard. Anyway, so we had... We have smoke and the wildflower smoke is seems to be coming back to us. We're getting wind out of the north, and it was pretty hazy, overcast today, and that smoke was responsible for the heat. So it when there's smoke in the upper atmosphere, it absorbs the sunlight way up there and warms the upper atmosphere so no clouds can form, causes a heat dome. And smoke is and particle material is not a good thing for climate change. It warms things up.
So let me ask you this, Henry. When Well, I'm going to call you a meteorologist, or at least an amateur meteorologist. Do in current forecasting with climate change and wildfire smoke, et cetera, and a lot of particulate matter, do you think the weather people, they factor that in when they're trying to decide whether a heat dome is likely to happen, or is it just happened so suddenly that they can't really predict it ahead of time?
No. I think that they are seeing the effects of that smoke and tracking where the jet stream is likely to carry it, and it's built into the forecast. And interestingly enough, yesterday's version of Volts by David Roberts got into coal-fired power plants.
Oh.
And coal-fired power plants, there's still 250 of them in the United States, and they produce about 20% of the nation's electricity. And one of those strings of orders that that Trump signed first day in office was an order requiring a coal-fired power plant that was going to shut down that day to stay open and continue operating. And another order he signed was to go to next day, where a gas and oil-fired power plant was to shut down and be taken out of commission, and he ordered that one to stay open. So he was pulling out the stops for continuing to pollute. And what's interesting is that burning of fossil fuel for electricity contributes considerably to our CO2 emissions. It does about 15% of the country's CO2 emissions. But if you look at it from a black particulate matter, kind of like smoke, it's the fine black matter that isn't burned completely.
That gets in your lungs. Yeah, that stuff. Yeah.
It contributes 3,200 times the global warming effect on a short-term basis, a 20-year basis, not thousands-a-year basis that the CO2 is up there for, but on a 20-year basis, which we kind of care about, it is so much more powerful than the CO2, and yet we focus on the CO2, and we don't focus on shutting them down. So that's kind of future lead into to our guest, who is talking about how we might combat all of these negatives that are happening.
And we'll get to that shortly. And, yeah, the wildfires are burning lots of places. Alex Smith, during his show Radio EcoShock, was talking about the fires that aren't just happening in Western Canada, but some serious wildfires and sort of record-setting particulate matter happening in places like Arizona and New Mexico. And we don't really think about wildfires here in northern New England. And yet, in the last few days, now that this drought has been going on, there are a lot of people thinking about it. In fact, I saw a map of the entire state, and every county and every town in the state is at least moderate risk of fires. And Orange County, which is just across the river from here, so I would say we're pretty darn close to that, is one of the counties with a high risk of a fire getting started. So I should remind everyone that, hey, forget about the fireworks. You know, you might want to do that permanently. No campfires, no burning trash in your backyard. You are not going to get a fire permit from your local fire commissioner. And we should be at our utmost care right now and really always about any kind of combustion. And, of course, Mother Nature with a lightning bolt could take care of that on its own. But it's a pretty serious situation with how dry most of the United States and a lot of places in the world are right now.
Yeah, I saw last night on the news, I guess it was Greece maybe, was having wildfires right around cities. And there was a little movie clip of a fireman going in there with a big broom or something trying to knock a fire down in a little shrub, and he ran his broom through it, and the darn thing just exploded and created much worse fire than what he was fighting before. He had to run for it.
Yeah, he had to get out of there. Jeez, pretty bad. You can read a little bit more locally. Darren Marcy in today's Herald is writing about the fire risk expected to remain elevated into the near future. In fact, there's an outside chance of a stray shower this afternoon, so we're talking to you live on a Thursday. And then there's no rain in the forecast except a chance of a thunderstorm maybe in parts of the state on Sunday afternoon. So pretty serious situation. Shall we shift to the condor here, Henry? We're up to about the 10-minute mark on the show.
For the condor.
Okay, this is from Bird Note. Bringing Condor Home is the episode we're going to listen to today, and I want to make sure that, okay, good, that is off. Let's bring it up.
This is Bird Note. Ayukwe nikichu. Nek now Tiana Williams Klassen, Esi Pulik Neme. I am a Yurok tribal member from the village of Huelquo. My home is in northwestern California, where the Klamath River meets the Pacific Ocean, and in the mountains and the beautiful coastlines here. The Yurok people have co-evolved with this region as both caretakers and recipients of its bounties. Yurok and surrounding tribes are deeply connected with our traditional lands, but that relationship was profoundly damaged after the California Gold Rush. Yurok were forced off of our land, which was then managed for extraction. This caused many casualties. Preganish, or California condor, was driven locally extinct. Ecologically, as scavengers, condors are the ultimate environmental cleanup crew. Culturally, Preganish ties closely to local tribal obligations as world renewal people. Preganish carries our prayers for the world to be in balance. Our elders have long been committed to restoring Preganish to Yurok ancestral territory, and it has been the focus of my entire career. The Yurok tribe has forged a partnership with the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to bring condors back home. I'm happy to say that my 4-year-old daughter will grow up with condors in her sky. In May 2022, after more than a century, the first condors flew free in Yurok country. We are bringing Preganish, a member of our community, back home. For Bird Note, this is Tiana Williams Clausen.
Wow, new word of the week there. Preganish. I'm putting that.
Footnote. Yeah, that was new to me too. They're a tribal nation that lives there on the border between California and Oregon. And it's a very diverse that Klamath River basin goes all the way from desert to rainforest. It has very, very diverse ecosystem. So just a little background on the California condor. By 1982, there are only 22 California condors existing in the wild, mostly in Southern California. And that was not only the gold rush, human caused, but lead poisoning from their scavengers, and they scavenge carcasses, and so lead bullets in buckshot and carcasses, man-made cause, habitat loss, man-made cause. DDT effects all drove their decline, and then they captured those last 22 and did a captive breeding programs and then reintroduced them in the wild, which is what you just heard.
Wow. Yeah.
But I just note that the human impact shouldn't go without note.
No, it really shouldn't. Just to remind folks that we do run Bird Note each week and a lot of public radio stations around the country. In fact, I did do a little editing there. There was a plea or a request for some funding for Bird Note, but the woman was also talking about how public radio stations, not ours, fortunately, at the moment, but ones that were tied closely with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are losing significant amounts of funding, and they do mostly, those stations, carry important public affairs programs like Bird Note. So you should keep that in mind as far as public media in your area where you're ever listening to this show. Henry, I've got all kinds of things here, but we're almost a quarter of the way through the show. Should we think about talking a little bit about Solarfest and welcoming our guests to the studio?
Absolutely.
All right.
Todd and I both attended Solarfest, and I can say from my perspective that it was not as well attended as it should be, but was a marvelous program. And the new facility is still is blooming, getting better and better, and they have a lot of solar up. And there were all nature of things in the program, and one of those things was an effort by our guest, Alan E. Baer, who currently resides in Chelsea, and is looking for a way to save the EPA.
And, tall order.
And it's a tall order, but and he's doing that in part by getting the word out that the Trump administration continues to not only require that oil-fired and coal-fired power plants continue to stay online, and has gone further to do other things with that, which I'm sure you can tell us about, but that they want to take down the science and deny that there's anything bad like the loss of the condor that comes from human activity.
Yeah, and so, and Vermont affected by another recent decision by the Trump administration. There was some funding that was going to come to several states around the country that had been passed as part of the IRA bill back during the Biden administration. And the funding that was completely taken away was going to provide funding for solar that was going to benefit low-income Vermonters who normally would not have any access based on income to having renewable energy in their homes. Well, that program is kaput. So another sort of move by...
Well, it's not quite kaput. It's in the courts. Number of states, including Vermont, is weighing in to push back and see if we can... retrieve that funding.
Yeah,
it'll take some while, and maybe the Supreme Court will decide that doing Trump's will is the will of the people. And
that's going back to gloom and doom. Let's try to get a brighter or at least a more positive outlook on things. And let's welcome Alan Baer to the Green Zine Studios. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. And you had a busy solar fest down there. You gave how many presentations?
Six over the course of 3 days.
Six over the course of 3 days. Wow. And so let's see what your mission is all about.
Bring Alan up in the mic. Some.
Yeah, that mic should be up higher so that you're right on top of it. Yeah, if it's high and you're talking directly into it, that looks
okay.
Better.
Okay.
That's
this
good.
Better?
That's very good.
Yes, well, the EPA is attempting to rescind the endangerment finding and 31 other regulations that essentially protect our communities from greenhouse gas emissions. I would quote that, first of all, the endangerment finding is a 2009 rule under Section 202 of the Clean Air Act. And it states that air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to both endanger public health and to endanger public welfare, shall be regulated. In prior to 2016, again, to be clear, the Clean Air Act was passed in 1972,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't until the state of Massachusetts decided to sue the EPA in the early 2000s that there were not any regulations, that no enforcement by the EPA. So, the state of Massachusetts sued and demanded there be enforcement. And the final finding, which is called the endangerment finding, is a 2009 rule that basically says the EPA must regulate greenhouse gases. Well, you might say industry protested. We can't afford to do this. We don't have the technology. It'll be too expensive for the consumer. But nonetheless, the EPA persisted in spite of these challenges. In 2016, the Supreme Court upheld the ruling of the endangerment finding and basically said that all greenhouse gases, there are six greenhouse gases in addition to carbon, need to be regulated. This was the basis, for example, of the CAFE standards, the combined average fuel efficiency for cars and light trucks, power plants, and also were regulated in facilities in the oil and gas sector, in the chemical sector. In all, including the endangerment finding, there are 31 regulatory standards that have significantly improved the reduction of greenhouse gases in the auto sector alone. I believe that it's been reduced by 40%.
So this was all happening, as you said, that it was sort of ratified in 2016. Of course, that was an election year at that point when it was ratified, and the court had a different makeup at that time, the Supreme Court. Is that when sort of the data is coming in showing how much reductions there have been since that time? And now what we're seeing is a big attempt to roll all that back.
Yes. The EPA is trying to rescind the endangerment finding, as well as the 30 other regulatory framework for industries of all sorts that are responsible for greenhouse gas
emissions.
How
do they go about that? We know that the EPA administrator is appointed by the president, and we have the same president that got elected originally in 2016. And on his first day, he was talking about getting all the coal mines going again. So we know, I guess we just heard that Lee Zeldin is the head of the EPA, no friend of the environment. But structurally, how does can the EPA just by fiat say, hey, this is it, we're just trashing this endangerment finding? Or is it's going to be in the courts for a while?
Oh, it will be indeed. There will be lawsuits. But let me give you some background on this.
Okay.
So Chris Wright, the new administrator or secretary of the Department of Energy, has done a review of the endangerment finding, essentially appointing what I would say five climate deniers mm-hmm. to his research panel. And they have remarkably found that climate research since 2009 has invalidated earlier conclusions about greenhouse gases. For example, they claim that the current research has failed to establish a link between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, that the current research has failed to weigh the benefits of the activities that require greenhouse gas emissions, that they've failed to separate safe climate change, a new term that I'm not familiar with.
Wow. An Orwellian term. Yeah. Hey, let's have some more safe climate change.
Yeah.
It's good for you.
And they've quite remarkably discovered that the science has failed to demonstrate, and I quote, an injury in fact. Hmm. There's no harm to climate change. And they've concluded that the endangerment findings, the 2009 endangerment findings, rested on inadequate, erroneous, and deficient arguments and evidence.
Mm. Wow. That's a pretty strong statement from the appointed panel there of not scientists. Clearly none of these people are scientists.
Yeah, I don't know
what their
background
is. Yeah,
but nonetheless, they had a mission to change the course, and that's how they've gone about it.
Mm.
I think the truth of the matter here is, and I will quote from a statement from Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator, and that is, we are driving a dagger straight into the heart of climate change religion and the green energy scam.
There goes that dagger. Well, they are doing a pretty good job of driving that in. Huh. Henry, we could go a lot of different directions here, but we haven't heard your voice. You got a comment or a question for our guests?
Well, I think there is a lot of negative activity, and I don't want to swim indefinitely on that. I think that as soon as possible, we ought to get on to some of the upcoming adventure that that our guest is going to go on to try to make sustainable energy and sensible living on this planet more Main Street and more understood across the country. Do you want to talk some more about the nasties that the Trump administration is doing before we jump into that, Alan?
Yes, I think we should focus on the risks that we face right now. And that is that Congress could nullify the 2009 endangerment finding or codify the updated findings of the Department of Energy in the U.S. Constitution. That's a high bar for them to reach, but nonetheless, I think there's going to be an effort to try to codify the updated findings. And if that happens, it's nearly irreversible. And what I mean by irreversible is that it'll be too late. You know, if it takes 5-10 years to get the 2009 endangerment finding reinstated, the amount of carbon emissions emitted into the atmosphere will be significantly damaging to our environment.
Right. It's a necessity that we do that, and the how do I say this? The the people who put together this new finding are a cast of characters who has been pushing back for the fossil fuel industry for years, and it's a very small group. In other words, the science is clearly against them, but this isn't, science isn't being looked at. It's kind of political will and cultural follow the leader behavior instead of paying attention to science. And I think it's important that we that message gets out there, and that we are we're taking it seriously. I mean, the if we miss this window, the likelihood of very, very serious climate change is really on our doorstep, or on, you know, maybe not our doorstep, maybe not my doorstep because I'm 85, but certainly our grandkids and kids' doorstep. And we're already seeing a less habitable world. Just the warming that has already taken place, there's more deaths from heat in Europe right now than there is from any other cause. And that's Europe. That's not people in sub-Saharan Africa without air conditioning. It's right here on our doorstep. And China certainly has done an excellent job of, you know, of polluting first, and continues to burn a lot of coal. But they have really ramped up and have taken hold of this moving to sustainable energy and to a friendlier world, And they've done it in part because they had so much air pollution that people's lives were really being restricted, influenced. People having to wear masks on the street all the time and
not leaving their apartments. Yeah, just staying home when the alert went out. Yeah,
pretty horrendous conditions in China. And in Bill McKibben's most recent newsletter, he pointed out that if you count all of the activities that China has done, producing solar panels and using them and switching to electric cars and battery technology and shipping that and shipping all those things around the world, that China this last year is actually responsible for a 1% reduction in CO2 emissions. I'm afraid that currently that's not being looked at by our Trump administration, and we need to get us, rather than going wholeheartedly ahead for doubling down on more fossil fuel burning, we need to be backing off and seeing if we can get into competition with China and partner with them some to be able to enjoy some of the production they have. I mean, they're doing. I'm seeing in Burlington College campus between the Champlain College in Vermont and UVM, I'm seeing just all kinds of people riding around on Chinese devices, scooters and bigger scooters, and some drive bikes and stuff that is, you know, $1,000 and under instead of $3,000 the way the fancier stuff is. The fancier stuff is nicer and will last longer, but it's the Volkswagen of the electrification movement.
Right. Maybe some of those folks won't even get around to buying a car, and certainly not buying a gas-driven car. Hey, just very briefly, and then I want to we're going to kind of go back in time, and then I want to go into the future with our guest, Alan Bear. So talking about the Clean Air Act and a lot of environmental legislation that was passed during the Richard Nixon administration, a lot of people who don't follow history that far back, I think the EPA was formed back then, and a whole lot of other legislation that students here and professors on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School talk about every day. Back then, even though it was a conservative, different type of conservative administration in the White House, scientists were very respected, and there was a lot of information coming in, epidemiological studies, et cetera, to sort of have objective information so that the politicians could actually have a bill that was drafted on accurate information and pass it and then adhere to it. Things have changed a whole lot in the more than 50 years since that bill was passed. As far as science being ignored, longtime EPA scientists leaving, being forced out, etc. Science definitely on the back foot with the current administration and other climate deniers. But Alan, you are planning to go and reach out to some young people that may not know so much about that early history. I believe you're planning a tour, and you've been involved with Green Energy Times for quite a while. Can you talk a little bit about your objectives as you head out, and how maybe the EPA could be protected and restored to its original objective goals for the citizenry of this country?
Yes. First thing I want to clarify is that I run a nonprofit corporation called the Renewable Nations Institute. And for a long time, we've been planning to partner with the Green Energy Times to expand the newspaper nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm attempting to do through a national tour. I'll visit major universities and state universities in every state in the country, as well as some of the large private universities, and hope to engage young people in setting up a chapter of the Green Energy Times. So there's a local distribution with local content, connecting consumers with the industry, with the energy efficiency and renewable sector, and with state programs and so forth, so that consumers can make good choices about the future of their energy, you know, where it comes from, understand how they can potentially reduce standby power and inefficient functioning appliances, and the benefits of transitioning to solar energy, whether it's grid tied or independent. So the Yale School on climate communications, I don't have the title correct, but they have stated through their research that 77% of Americans say they want more information about climate change. And as our federal government is reducing the outreach and taking down content on climate issues, on energy efficiency and renewable energy, for example, our mission is to be the source of information and the catalyst for action across the country.
So I just looked up your website, stopTheEPA.org. Are you going to change the title of that, or is that going to stay that way?
Oh, yes. That was the benefit of attending the SolarFest event. You know, it was an opportunity for me to talk to people that have been in this movement for a long time. And, you know, initially I was very upset about the effort of Zeldin and the EPA to rescind the endangerment findings. So, you know, my immediate response was, we've got to stop the EPA from doing this. I mean, I was angry, and I was even more angry at the quote of Lee Zeldin saying that we are going to be driving a dagger into the heart of climate religion. You know, I'm really offended by public officials that use that type of combative language, violent language, and really we have to turn this around. And one individual spoke up at one of my presentations and said, you know, we just really have to put a positive spin on this. He said it should be Save the EPA. Hmm. And so a new website will be coming up soon. The existing website will be linked to that. So if you enter Save the EPA or Stop the EPA, it'll go to the proper site.
Yeah, and you know what? You probably have already thought of this, but I'm sure they might not call it a mission statement, but when the EPA was first formed more than 50 years ago, I'm sure there were several paragraphs describing its mission and how it is here to provide good scientific objective information for decision makers to do good things for their constituents. And back to the constituents in a little bit. That I think a lot of people aren't really aware of what the EPA originally was founded and supposed to do. And I'm sure you're going to be talking about that with some of the young people you're going to meet on your tour. And, you know, I agree with that attender that went to one of your workshops that, and it's pretty hard these days to put a positive spin on some of this, but that, you know, we are the people. This country is made up of however many 300 and something million people. And, our rights to clean air and clean water and, you know, the pursuit of a healthy lifestyle, should continue to be guaranteed and not eroded. So, yes. I wish you luck. Sometimes I think it's a David versus Goliath. I mean, it's a pretty ugly Goliath that you're battling right now. But do you have a sense of, I mean, you're probably getting your tour ready, finding out the colleges you're going to go to. What sort of reception that you might get as you make your rounds?
Well, I think it'll be positive. I've been doing this for some time now in other formats.
Mm-hmm.
But our specific goals are to codify the 2009 endangerment finding in the U.S. Constitution. Okay, that will be a very heavy lift. I'm told that it'll take 39 states to agree to make any changes in the U.S. Constitution. And then secondly, for the U.S. to recognize that a healthy climate is a fundamental human right. And 163 other nations, I believe that's the correct number, have in fact codified that a healthy climate is a fundamental human right in their constitution.
Hmm. It reminds me a little bit, Henry, you recall that, of course, we talked about the Juliana case coming out of, I think it was out of Washington State, but the case up in Montana that was a state case brought by a number of students about a clause in the Montana Constitution about protecting the human right to a clean environment. That's being battled by fossil fuel interests in Montana quite vociferously, but there have been a few inroads legally, at least at the state level, and it looks like Alan, you're going to try to make that a whole lot more states.
Yes, indeed.
Henry?
Yes, and I might say that Volt's podcast, which I put in the notes along with Alan's websites, went on to say, you know, the if you look at this from a corporate point of view and from a just money making now, I don't care about the future point of view, clean energy and is financially the right thing to do. It's cheaper now, and it just makes sense. It's just stupid to be trying to hang on to old technologies that are so bad for the environment and for our living on Earth. So that's really a very positive message. And if you look at what's driving, I guess I've commented on this before, but if you look at what's driving the demand for electricity, a lot of it is data centers and AI. And they are ramping up very rapidly and very hungry for power. And putting new gas-fired power plants on, there's such a backlog for gas-fired power plants that there's a 10-year waiting line. They aren't going to wait for that. And if you want to look at nuclear, I went to one of the nuclear energy discussion reviews at SolarFest, and they have at least 10 years before they're going to be available, and even then they're going to be polluting us on an ongoing basis if they operate and causing bad outcomes. But solar and to some degree wind both can come on very fast, and again, Bill McKibben has written a new book on the world of solar and what can happen. And he points out that in Europe, when the pandemic came along in there, more specifically, when the Russian gas supply got shut down or drastically reduced for them, that they started doing balcony solar panels that you go to the equivalent of Home Depot or Lowe's, you buy them, bring them home, hang them on your balcony railing, take the cord, plug it in your wall outlet, and voila, you have solar energy offsetting your electric usage and making it so the grid can keep up with trying to do more heating and air conditioning than it had to do before as climate has gotten warmer. And one state in the United States allows you to do that, and no other states have the entrenched utility companies don't want that.
Interesting. It makes me think I'm headed towards a major camping area as part of a festival, and I saw this at SolarFest in the smaller campground there. You know, the portable solar panels set out. It was a sunny weekend. They had them lined up right outside their vehicle. They were collecting power that they were using on site. So kind of that direct control over your clean power consumption is really important. I think that type of discussion during your tour is going to be pretty active.
Yes. And I want to go a little bit deeper.
Okay.
I was in Vietnam as a soldier in the Marine Corps. And, you know, the first day I got there, I was just shocked at what was going on and committed to nonviolent resistance. Worked with soldiers that were transformed their lives because of the violence they had committed. And I want to say that Vietnam, to a large extent, was premised on the fact that, well, there's energy in the Mississippi River Delta. There's a lot of oil. The same goes for the Nigerian River Delta. And we were there to understand whether or not the Mekong River Delta had the same assets. There was a significant amount of activity, oil exploration in the Mekong Delta. And in fact, the whole swift boat movement was about protecting those the research for the oil industry. And I came to realize that fossil fuels are responsible for a lot of violence worldwide. So my original path, was about transitioning to nonviolent technologies, which I would want to argue that wind power and solar power to some extent, reduce the amount of violence internationally. But then, along came climate change, and I want to point out the 2007 effort by the UK and the Stern Review on the economic impacts of climate change. It's reported that climate change, with all of the externalities accounted for, are a burden of 20% of GDP on a global basis. So there's a lot of financial harm. Yeah, 20%. The Stern Review on the economic impacts of climate change, made a finding that the cost of climate change to the global economy is 20% of GDP on an annual basis.
And when did that report come out?
2007.
Yeah, 2007. I'm wondering if that number has gotten even higher. But even if it hasn't,
yeah,
that's a big number.
I'm certain that it has gotten higher.
Yeah.
I like to point out that the energy efficiency sector in the U.S. and the renewable sector in the U.S. has resulted in the last 10 years of being able to stabilize our carbon emissions and reduce our energy consumption. And I want to say that we have grown the economy by 5% per year on average over the last 10 years without increasing greenhouse gas emissions due to the fact that we have embraced energy efficiency and renewable energy. So it is very clear that the argument that the Trump administration is putting forth, that it is hindering economic growth, is entirely false.
Yay. Love that.
That's certainly a good point. And we have spoken with local nonprofits based in Montpelier and other places, particularly about conservation and efficiency. That, as Henry likes to say, that's the low-hanging fruit. The best kilowatt is the one that's not used at all. And some of the efficiency measures that have come in conservation have been very important to that. Obviously, being able to run vehicles, and as Henry was talking about, students on their electric rechargeable battery scooters, et cetera, moving away from fossil fuels as both in the thermal sector and the transportation sector, particularly here in Vermont, where fossil fuels contribute, transportation sector is like 50-60% of our pollution is coming from the transportation sector. So these are all good things. And, we're going to probably get down. We have a couple more items we want to get to the end of the show. So can you just sort of map out briefly, like, when do you think you're going to start taking off on this extended tour of colleges, Alan?
That'll start by the August 26th.
Soon. Wow. Yeah, right around the corner. And then how long do you expect to be away?
However long it takes.
Whoa. Well, yeah. It might be a while before we can get Alan back in the studio.
Well, your last project was to bring solar technology and the internet to the Galapagos Islands, and you were at that for what, 6 years, right?
No, that was 8 years, a little bit
eight
longer
years.
Even. It started in 2001, and we finished in 2009. We had the commissioning ceremony. Yeah, that took a long time. I want to say that, the lead time for development of major renewable energy or any new technology in the energy sector is a very long time. So we need to really look at this as a climate emergency and do what we can to foster
ramp
transition.
It up.
Well, I'm glad that you are out there on the front lines and speaking to some minds that aren't necessarily all set in one direction or not. People that are getting, 18 to age 25, maybe 30, that are in college environments that are seeking really accurate information. And I'm glad that you're going to be out there providing it. And of course, just one brief sort of political, not really a statement, but those midterm elections that are coming up, we know that the youth vote often is a pretty big tipping point. Typically, that sector of the population does not turn out, but with the way things are going and with people like Alan touring around and our senior senator going into districts that wouldn't normally be all that wild about trying to get behind the environment, I think there's some hope in a couple of years. Yeah. Henry?
Yeah, I want to put a plug in for going to Alan's website and signing up, and then when the time comes around and he has a fundraiser, if you can go to that and even just put a dollar in, it's going to be very important to him to have this project move forward. To have a lot of people's names, and we'll bring that up when that website is up and operating in a way that you can put a buck in and help him get this campaign going.
Yeah. Right,
and even more importantly, there'll be a petition that registered voters can sign. We're hoping to get millions of signatures on that petition to Congress to do both, to stop the EPA effort to rescind the endangerment finding, to have it codified in the U.S. Constitution, as well as recognize the basic human right to a healthy climate. My final statement, if I were to have a final statement in this talk, would be to quote Barack Obama. I'm not certain that I'll have it 100% accurate, but it's a very simple quote. He's saying that, we are, in fact, the first generation that's been impacted by climate change, and we are likely going to be the last generation that can do anything about it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes,
that is a good
I think
quote.
That's very timely, and I think that that's the level that we have to wake up to and embrace, because I just was visiting with someone this morning, and they were very interested in the details of how things worked and why things weren't good for the environment and what they could do about it, but they didn't grasp that it had their lives grabbed by the shoulders and they were being shaken by it, which is, I think, really what's happening with climate change. We need to realize it's clear and present danger, and now's the time that needs action.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to catching up with you. Maybe you could check in from the road sometime during your tour, Alan.
I will do that.
All right, we'll get folks to know about the petition and about following you on your website and contributing and making your trip sustainable. Really appreciate you coming by GreenZine today.
Thank you.
All right, Henry, we've got just about a little over 3 minutes to go. And before we get into a little bit more news, another song here. This is Merle Saunders and Melvin Seals with their version of Fire on the Mountain. Fire very much in the news. We do want to thank Solaflect for helping us out today. Of course, a solar company based down in Norwich, also building a local economy, very good about pulling the community together in a sustainable way. Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, of course, we were just there, and Wit and Grit and the Yes We Can Collective. Hey, pick up the Herald if you can, if you're local, because that's a way of keeping up on not just local news and headlines from politicians and basic commissions and stuff, but also about the environment. There's a story about the ongoing litigation about Tunbridge Legal Trails, but just want to remind people that the trails are open. Despite this litigation, they're open to non-motorized use, so just keep that in mind as you read that story. Henry, I won't get to a couple other things, so I'm going to toss it back to you in case you have a couple things you want to ping our listeners with.
No, go for it.
Okay.
You've got news that I've been keeping you from.
I'll just touch base on some things that they might. Well, there's your Volts. Here's an interesting one. This to go to the First Amendment, which fortunately here at Free Vermont Radio, we do respect the First Amendment. There was somebody on an energy committee in Milton, Vermont, who wrote a letter about some of the backsliding that's happening in the state of Vermont and by the current administration and by legislators on both sides of the aisle as far as supporting the Global Warming Solutions Act and other environmental legislation. And he was forced to leave his position on the Energy Committee by the Select Board in that town. So even we know that down in Washington, got to be very careful what you say if you want to keep your job with the administration. But you could look this up. It's at Vermont Digger. It's an op-ed piece from Jack Pidblato. The Trump administration's attack on free speech is alive in Milton, Vermont. The resounding message of the administration, free speech comes with a steep price. Henry's got some links probably to that Bill McKibben piece, so there's always a lot of information you can find at our website, WFVR.org. And got about a minute to go. Let me just click over to one other spot to point out another article. We did that one already. Oh, over here, another op-ed piece about housing in Vermont and how sometimes some of the housing initiatives are bumping up against some environmental protections. This came out on August 7th. Just go to vtdigger.org and look under their opinion pieces, and you can read a piece by Miriam Varan entitled Environmental Overshoot in Our Vermont Backyard. Why don't we just leave it with Fire on the Mountain? Henry, looking forward to joining you next week on GreenZine. And once again, thanks to our guest, Alan Baer.
Yes, and thank you all your listeners, and spread the word.
Indeed.